Okay, welcome. My name is Divine. This is episode 300 of the Divine Intervention Podcast. And I'm going to be calling this the coronavirus/COVID-19 podcast for the US MLEs. This podcast, maybe I should first off start off by saying, I'm pretty grateful first to be seen the first day of April. With this coronavirus COVID-19 pandemic, there's been, millions of people that have lost their lives all over the world. So I guess one message I want to put out there today is just be grateful, just be thankful. I know many people about 2 weeks ago, they found out that they did not match they had to go into the SOAP process or they did not match to their preferred program. But remember that when there is life, there is hope. And the fact that you're alive means that, you still have something to do on this planet. So, there are many people that there are definitely some people that probably planned to go through the SOAP process or go through the match process that because of COVID-19, their lives were taken away from them and they were not even able to see the match, the SOAP or whatever. Those people, I'm sure if they were given the opportunity to be alive now, even if they didn't match or even if they couldn't get through the SOAP process, they probably choose that. So again, bad circumstances happened to some people 2 weeks ago. But let's remember to be grateful. There's this part of the Bible that says, in all things give thanks because this is the will of God the Father. So I'll encourage you to be thankful. I most certainly am thankful. I've just heard of so many things, many families. I'm a big watcher of the NBA. And just people who their family members have perished from COVID and stuff. So it's pretty rough on a lot of people, right? So the fact that you are complete or you have a complete family right now is reason enough. Just the fact that you can take a breath is reason enough to be thankful. So I think I'll encourage you to be thankful. And I guess I'm also thankful that we've hit a big milestone on the website. This is episode 300. And, by the grace of God, I will make many, 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 many more podcasts. This is just, I don't think we've even started as a podcast website. At least that's my personal belief. I believe that, God is taking us to bigger places, more and more podcasts, even better podcasts than currently exist. But I'm grateful to have episode 300, right? By the grace of God, will come a long way. So, 300 podcasts in, I'm very happy with that. But again, it almost reminds me that, Divine, you could do better. You could have more than 300. So, just thankful for that. But, also like a reminder to, work harder and do better work out there. Okay. So, we're going to be talking about coronavirus COVID-19. This podcast, I'm intentionally going to say that this is for all the US MLEs. The thing is, I would discuss many things that you would potentially see on the US MLEs. And I will try to discuss again a lot of pathophysiology because this is just one thing that many people still struggle with. The coronavirus is just understanding pathophysiology. There's a lot of misinformation out there. Understanding the mechanisms behind the vaccines, why the vaccines were made a certain way. So we'll talk about it from pretty much every angle. So if you're studying, if you're taking any of the USMLE exams, step one, step two, CK, step three, I'll encourage you to pay close attention. The thing is, God willing, I'm going to be making a lot of integrations today, So I will strongly encourage you, if you can, to just really try to get those integrations down. I'll make integrations with immunology, with pharmacology, with cardiology, with pulmonology. So even if this is, again, a coronavirus or a COVID-19 podcast, you'll learn a ton, right? And again, obviously, this podcast, I need to throw in the legal disclaimer that it's not meant for clinical care. But the thing is, you'll learn a lot from this podcast. Again, it may be on the lengthier side of things, but it's going to be a floridly high your podcast. And I think it's going to be very worth your while. And I've also designed this podcast to be very thorough, right? So you will have like an extremely solid basis in understanding pretty much everything about coronavirus COVID-19 from this podcast, or at least I'll say the high-yield bits of information, right? So, for the folks that are taking step one, well, what do we know about coronavirus? Well, again, they could easily make this a question about a person that has some kind of travel history, right? or a person that works in some kind of occupation where they interact with lots of people, right? And then they'll tell you that, oh, you know, the person over the last like 24 hours, the person has, you know, been crashing and burning. They've been having profound shortness of breath. They may have like a dry cough, or they may have a productive cough. They may be having high fevers, right? And you notice that, you know, their O2 sats are really low, right? If you see that, you know, again, especially on the newer USMLE exams, you really want to think about a person having coronavirus, right? Remember, it's an enveloped, linear, single-stranded RNA virus, right? And it actually has a helical capsid, right? So you remember, for people that are taking step one, unfortunately, your friends at the MBME, they still love to test those identification things, right? So you know, all these identification. But the thing is, for coronavirus, though, there's a lot of stuff they could potentially test, right? And the thing is, some of these questions that describe experiments, those are very easy fodder for COVID-19, because, and again, instead of saying coronavirus, I'll just say COVID-19, right? Because there's just lots of integrations with immunology that you can really throw in on a test. So again, if you pay attention, take good notes on this podcast, I think you'll find it to be extremely helpful, right? So the thing is, when a person gets the coronavirus, right, what's going to happen? Well, the thing is, you know, many times they'll be symptomatic a few days after exposure, right? They'll be symptomatic a few days after exposure. And, you know, many times you're still going to be infectious for about 14 or more days after you've been exposed, right? Now, one other thing your friends at the MBME care about, right, is knowing what are the risk factors. Again, we live in this MBME era of risk factors, right? So what are some risk factors that put people at, you know, high risk for like really bad disease with COVID-19, right? Remember, if you're old, being over the age of 60, like over the age of 60 for the most part, right, is associated with really bad outcomes, right? So the older you get, the worse the disease you get, and the higher the risk of death, right? But if you also have like just other bad chronic diseases, hypertension, right? Pulmonary disease like COPD, asthma, diabetes. Remember, diabetes crushes a person's immune system, right? All those things can place a person, or if the person is immunocompromised, let's say they have HIV, right? Or they have an immunodeficiency disease, or they are on immunosuppressive therapy because they are transplant recipients, right? All those people, again, these are all risk factors for a person having a really bad disease, right, with coronavirus. Now, how is this stuff transmitted? Well, for the most part, it's transmitted by the respiratory route, right? It's transmitted by the respiratory route, right? So many times people can get this through like aerosols, through respiratory droplets, right? You can even get it from contact, right? But again, for the most part, that's not the main route of transmission. The main route of transmission is the respiratory route, right? And the thing is, there are some risk factors that increase your risk of receiving the illness from someone that has it, right? The first one is if you interact with those people closer, right? That's why we advocate for all the social distancing. The closer you interact with these people, the higher your risk, but also the longer you interact with these people, right? So that's why you want to have very quick, efficient interactions with people if you interact with people during this COVID-19 pandemic, right? Now, one thing that's actually higher to understand is that people that work in healthcare, it's actually higher to understand that these people, aerosol generating procedures can potentially be the thing that gives them COVID-19, right? In fact, many hospitals, they've implemented many, you know, algorithms or many initiatives to try to curb the use of aerosol generating procedures, or maybe use alternative procedures that give you the same effect to an aerosol generating procedure, so that you reduce the risk of these healthcare workers getting these problems, right? So, you know, things like, you know, the obvious ones like intubations, right? But other ones we don't really think about, like if you're getting like some kind of nebulized treatment, this is something that happens on many medicine floors in the ICUs, people getting like nebulized bronchodilators and stuff. Those things are aerosol generating procedures. They are very high risk procedures for people contracting COVID-19, right? If you're a pulmonologist, if you're performing a bronchoscopies, right? Or you're doing like this non-invasive positive pressure ventilation, right? So like CPAP, BiPAP, right? Those things can increase the risk of a person getting COVID-19, right? So those aerosol generating procedures, they are things you want to keep at the back of your mind as things that are very high risk procedures in healthcare workers for potentially getting a coronavirus, right? So the thing is, how do we diagnose this stuff? Well, for the most part, you want to go ahead and pick performing some kind of nasopharyngeal swab, right? And remember, you know, in general, when you take these, although you can use sputum samples or whatever, but in general, most people, vast majority, again, the classic thing is to do a nasopharyngeal swab, right? And then you'll send that swab for reverse transcription PCR, right? Usually within a few hours, you can get those test results back, right? So you do RT-PCR, again, reverse transcription, because remember, it's an RNA virus, right? It's an RNA virus. So that, you know, that RNA, it will make sense that reverse transcription PCR, right? Because again, you want to do reverse transcription to convert that RNA to DNA, right? I mean, it's kind of amazing how far along PCR has gone in this world. I remember when I just moved to the US, I used to do, you know, some research with PCR and stuff. This was maybe like 8-9 years ago or something like that. And it's just amazing how quickly the technology has kind of advanced, right? Now, you know, they may try to trick you on an MBM exam into picking a chest CT. A chest CT is not recommended. Even if you have chest CT results that look like a person has coronavirus, you need to confirm, right, with reverse transcriptase or PCR. In fact, one very smart thing your friends at the MBM can do is they can make this a biostats question, right? So the thing is, a chest CT is probably pretty sensitive. It's not probably, it is pretty sensitive for identifying people that potentially have coronavirus. But remember, whenever you have a test that is very sensitive, you're very likely going to pick up a lot of false positives, right? So a chest CT can almost be like a screening test you can employ in an ED, right? But the thing is, if you want to confirm, you need to do the RT-PCR, right? You need to do the RT-PCR. Right. So again, the chest CT is very sensitive, but again, there are many things that have similar findings on chest CT as coronavirus that are not coronavirus. Right. So chest CT, very sensitive, right? But it is not specific. So you absolutely, absolutely still need to confirm the diagnosis by using reverse transcriptase PCR. Right. And what would you find on a chest CT? Right. For the most part, again, because it's like a pulmonary interstitial disease, you're going to find bilateral ground glass opacities, right? And the thing is, usually it's typically asymmetric, right? So one side of the lung will not look like a carbon copy of the other side of the lung. And typically it's also peripheral, right? So it's going to be predominantly subpleural. So just below the pleural lining in a predominance, right? So that's usually what you're going to find on a chest CT. And usually these people, they actually don't have pleural effusions, right? They usually don't have pleural effusions, right? And remember, when people have COVID-19, right? Many of them that die of respiratory failure, ARDS is the thing that usually kills them, right? But again, we're going to talk more about treatment down the line, right? So let's talk about how do we prevent the spread of coronavirus. Again, the classic public health measures. Again, your friends at the MBME with the newer exams, they really, really love public health measures, right? So you want to keep things like physical and social distancing at the back of your mind, right? So remember, you want to keep at least 6 feet apart, right? So you want to practice, again, social distancing. That's really helpful. Quarantining, right? So if, for example, you've been exposed to a person that potentially has the virus, right? You want to at least self-quarantine for roughly around 14 days. You know, again, some of these things I'm seeing in this podcast are very fluid, right? This pandemic has been evolving. There's all these first wave, second wave, whatever wave, right? So, you know, but for the most part, the things I'm going to discuss today are pretty accurate, right? So in general, if you've been exposed to a person, if a person has been exposed to some individual that has been discovered to have the virus, right? You want to self-quarantine for about 14 days, right? And then remember, hand washing is also a very effective technique. I mean, basically, like household soap, for the most part, explodes like the viral capsid, right? So it pretty much destroys the virus, right? And if you're using a hand sanitizer, you need to make sure that you're using a hand sanitizer that has at least 60% alcohol, right? Now, also using masks, right, is very helpful, right? Like homemade masks, surgical masks, these are all things that are helpful for preventing the spread and also preventing you from getting it, right? But if you have it, it also prevents you from spreading it to other people, right? And also the vaccine, right? Getting the vaccine is also helpful. I mean, at least I believe like the Pfizer or Moderna vaccine or whatever has been shown to be greater than 90% effective. And I'll say some more things because, again, for people that are taking step one, I can see the MBME going the immunology route with a lot of these COVID-19 questions, right? You'll see why in a few minutes, right? But again, you'll see why this stuff is pretty high yield to understand, right? And, you know, also like increasing ventilation indoors, right? So I know this is pretty common in certain populations of people where for some reason they don't turn on fans, they don't turn on air conditioning in their homes. If that's a crowded home, and that's why unfortunately this is a problem in a developing countries, right? Because I remember, you know, in Nigeria, at least back in the day, I remember that there'll be times for months no electricity, right? So if there's no electricity, obviously your fans are not running, your air conditioning is not running, right? In a crowded environment, that significantly increases the risk of people contracting a COVID-19, right? And again, you know, other things that help is, again, don't touch, if you have an unwashed hand, right? If your hand is unwashed, don't touch your eyes, don't touch your nose, don't touch your mouth. That's a very effective means of preventing the spread of the virus, right? It always just kind of boggles my mind when I see people, they literally have just shake someone's hand, or they've just touched the surface that many other people have touched. And then you see them cleaning out their eyes, putting their fingers in their nose, putting their hands in their mouth, right? Again, those people are just putting themselves at unnecessary risk, essentially, right? And then remember, if you're wearing a mask, right, in general, a mask with an exhalation valve, especially if you have the virus, is not a good thing to do, right? A mask with an exhalation valve, because guess what? Those masks and many of these things that have these exhalation valves are like some of these N95 masks. Again, it's good. It's protecting you, the wearer, right? But the thing is, if you have COVID-19, those exhalation valves are essentially helping you spread that to others. That's why, for the most part, many of these airlines or most of these are public buildings, they don't let people that have masks with exhalation valves kind of get into them, right? So I know at least that's a big thing with the airline industry for sure, right? And then remember, if you're a healthcare worker and you're working with people that potentially have COVID-19, you want to use a respirator. That's the buzzword you want to remember for NBM exams, respirators, right? Respirators. And the respirators you want to use on NBM exams are N95 respirators, right? So the thing is, many of us, you know, in the midst of this pandemic, we've heard of many different respirators, N95, P100, R99, blah, 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 blah. So what in the world do these things mean? Literally, let's deconstruct the term, right? So what does the N stand for? The N means that the respirator is not resistant to oil, right? R, which you may see on some respirators, tells you that, oh, it's resistant to oil. But typically, it means that you're only going to use that thing once, right? You're going to use that respirator once. It's like for single use once. Although, unfortunately, you know, with the limited supply of PPE in certain healthcare systems, you know, people had to reuse many of these things. But then the P, right, means that it's oil proof, right? So N means not resistant to oil. R means resistant to oil. P means that it's oil proof, right? And you can reuse it a lot, right? I mean, one thing that kind of boggles me sometimes about the way healthcare systems work is, you know, you kept reusing these N95s. But the thing is, right out there in the world, there's all these P100 respirators that are sold quite widely, right? And even provide somewhat better protection than the N95 respirators, right? And you can reuse them, right? So it's like it offers every single advantage. But some healthcare systems say that, oh, you know, it doesn't look cosmetically good. We don't want to scare our patients. But the thing is, you know, we're in the midst of a pandemic, right? It's a pretty bad pandemic. You need to make some concessions, right? And you also need to protect your healthcare staff that are working with you, right? But that's a different conversation, right? So these respirators, they're pretty good because, you know, essentially, they prevent like all this dust or these liquid droplets in the air, especially those that are like roughly on the, you know, around like 0.3 microns, right? They really protect, right? So really that number you see at the end, like N95, it just talks about the efficiency level of the filter, right? So like an N95 mask, right? Again, the 95 means, oh, it's 95% effective at getting rid of these, you know, protecting you or filtering out these liquid droplets and dust from getting into your airway, all right? So obviously the P100s, again, it's not 100%, but it's like 99.97% effective, right? Those P100 respirators, they're very cheap, they're widely available, but they're amazing. The only problem is many of them, again, unfortunately, have exhalation valves, right? So again, it'll protect you, the wearer, but if you have COVID-19, it would not protect the people that are necessarily around you, right? And then it's also high yield to know that vitamin D deficiency actually increases a person's risk of having like a severe COVID-19 infection. Again, it's limited data, but it is definitely positive data, right? So if a person is vitamin D deficient, right? So let's say a person has like dark skin, right? Or you work in radiology, for example, we're in a dark room all the day, or you live in a very cold climate, right? Especially in this pandemic, taking vitamin D is very helpful. I mean, vitamin D is also just helpful for many different things, right? So that's actually one high yield thing to keep at the back of your mind. Okay, so now that we've done away with many of these social science things, let's begin to go into the basic sciences. Let's begin to go more into the clinical sciences that your friends at the MDME really, really love, right? So the thing is, COVID-19, the virus, right? It has four key proteins, right? These are four key proteins you want to remember for your exams. And I'm going to use a mnemonic. I call them like MENS. So like M-E-N-S, MENS, to remember the proteins, right? So there's obviously the M-glycoprotein, right? The M-glycoprotein is essentially like a protein that actually helps in bringing like nutrients into the virus, right? So it helps for like transmembrane nutrient transport, right? And then there's the E protein. The E protein is the envelope protein, right? And then the N is the nucleocapsid protein, right? And I'll argue that probably the most important protein here is the S protein, right? The S protein is the spike protein. In fact, I'm going to spend quite a bit of time on the spike protein, right? Because it's very helpful to understand quite a bit of pathophysiology with the virus, right? So the thing is, why is that spike protein pretty virulent? Well, let's look at how people get COVID-19 essentially, right? So remember, in the lungs, we have two major kinds of cells, right? Two major kinds of pneumocytes. There's the type 1 pneumocytes, right? That, you know, they are simple squamous epithelium. They allow you to have gas exchange. And then there's the type 2 pneumocytes, right? Which are cuboidal epithelium. Remember, those type 2 pneumocytes, one thing they do is they have the ability to produce surfactant. Remember, they store that surfactant in those lamellar bodies, right? That's a high-yield tidbit of USMLE information to know, right? But those type 2 pneumocytes, they also have the ability to undergo metaplasia when a person has lung injury to type 1 pneumocytes, right? So remember, it's a kind of metaplasia, right? Where you're going from one cell type to another. Right, so you're going from simple cuboidal epithelium to simple squamous epithelium, right? So they have the ability to undergo metaplasia. The only problem with these, I guess it's not a problem, but many of us also kind of know this basic science detail that angiotensin 1 being converted to angiotensin 2 happens in the lungs, right? Under the action of angiotensin converting enzyme, right? So the thing is, many of these type 2 pneumocytes, they have a lot of ACE2 receptors, right? They have a lot of ACE2 receptors. It's a protein, right? It exists on the surfaces of these type 2 pneumocytes. The thing that happens is that these ACE2 receptors on type 2 pneumocytes actually binds the spike protein that comes from COVID-19, right? And the thing is, this spike protein actually has two subunits, right? So it has the S1 subunit. The S1 subunit is the part of the protein that literally binds to the ACE2 receptor, right? So that's the receptor binding domain for the ACE2 receptor, the S1 protein. Remember, again, I said the spike protein has two subunits. It has the S1 subunit and it has the S2 subunit. The S1 subunit is the receptor binding domain, right? So in fact, the S1 subunit is ultimately what you should think of as the antigen that is in many of the vaccines that have been produced for against COVID-19, right? Because again, if you can make something that can essentially obliterate the S1, you know, obliterate binding of the S1 to the ACE2 protein, then that will prevent binding of that of the virus to your type 2 pneumocytes, right? And then the S2 is the portion that mediates fusion of the virus to our pneumocytes, right? So S1 again is for receptor binding to the ACE2 receptor. The S2 domain of the spike protein mediates fusion. If you notice, many of these RNA viruses, they operate by a somewhat similar mechanism, right? Again, like HIV virus, we know of many of those receptors, GP41, GP, all those things, right? This is not a HIV podcast, so I'm going to kind of hold myself back there so that this podcast does not become unnecessarily long, right? But again, it's kind of high yield to understand that. So if you kind of think about it, we know that the type 2 pneumocytes, they help us regenerate the lung, right? They literally help us regenerate the lung after injury. So if you're infecting the type 2 pneumocytes, you can see why it's very hard for these people, for their lungs to repair itself after they've had a potential injury, right? After they've had potential injury. Now, one thing to know is these ACE2 receptors, we don't only find them on the lung pneumocytes. We also find them in many other parts of the body, right? So ACE2 receptors, you can find them in the heart, you can find them in the stomach, right? Like your gastric epithelium, you can find them on your duodenal epithelium, you can even find them in the rectum, right? So the thing is, you can see that many people can get COVID-related, like myocardial injury, right? They can get COVID-related intestinal injury. They can get all these things because, again, the virus can potentially be tropic to these organs in the body, right? And the thing is, again, when the virus infects, right, there is a massive inflammatory response. In fact, many times, if you're measuring these people's labs, you'll notice that their CRP, their LDH, their ferritin, their D-dimer is elevated, right? These are all inflammatory markers. They'll be elevated in these people, right? So the thing is, the massive inflammation, again, is going to cause like cause septic shock, right? Increased vascular permeability in the lungs, right? So fluid begins to seep into the person's pulmonary interstitium, right? And that can cause like a non-cardiogenic pulmonary edema, right? In fact, it can also torch the person's kidneys and cause an acute kidney injury, right? So again, I think one thing that's very high to understand here, right, is again, that increased vascular permeability from the massive inflammation, right? Again, it can put fluid in the lungs, right? So the person, that's kind of essentially the pathophys behind these people getting ARDS, right? Remember, ARDS is an example of a non-cardiogenic pulmonary edema, right? It's an example of a non-cardiogenic pulmonary edema, right? So those people's pulmonary capillary wedge pressures, right, which is essentially a surrogate for left atrial pressures, it's going to be less than 18 on an MBM exam, right? So what, so obviously, right, if you kind of perform histology on these people, you're going to see like a lot of, you know, diffuse alveolar damage, right? Because again, of the massive inflammation, and again, the virus is very immunogenic, right? It's super, super immunogenic, right? So it causes lots and lots and lots of problems, right? So let's talk about the vaccines, right? Because again, this is an area where you do need to understand there's a lot of cell biology, there's a lot of immunology. Your friends at the NBME can integrate with this, right? So let's kind of talk about the vaccines, right? So the thing is, actually, at least as of today, if I'm not mistaken, there's been roughly 12 vaccines made against the COVID-19, right? So they kind of fall into, I'll say, maybe like four major categories, right? So the first major category are these RNA vaccines, right? They are RNA vaccines. In fact, like the Pfizer BioNTech vaccine and also the Moderna vaccine, these actually RNA vaccines, right? So you may say, okay, Divine, well, this is a new class of vaccine. What's the mechanism of action of these vaccines? Well, it's actually relatively interesting and relatively simple if you just actually take the time to understand it, right? So the thing is, these are RNA vaccines. You're essentially giving mRNA to an individual, right? So if you give mRNA to an individual, essentially the thing that's going to happen is when the mRNA gets into the cell, the body is going to use its own translation machinery inside the cell, right, to make this mRNA into like a foreign protein, right? And then that foreign protein will then be broken down by proteasomes, right? Can be broken down by proteasomes if we're talking about the MHC1 response, right? But it can also be presented on MHC2. So essentially, this protein, you know, it can be picked up by dendritic cells. So when you inject the mRNA vaccine into an individual, right, it'll be picked up by dendritic cells. Those dendritic cells, again, you will translate the mRNA into protein. And then the dendritic cells, they'll be able to present that protein on MHC2. So you can develop humoral immunity in response to the vaccine. But also, because you can make that foreign protein, right, in the cytosol, you essentially can break down that protein with MHC1. I mean, break down that protein on proteasomes, right? And then when that protein is broken down by proteasomes, remember, there are these TAP proteins, right? TAP proteins, there's TAP1 and TAP2. They will get those broken down proteins into the endoplasmic reticulum, right? And then remember, you can ultimately go ahead and load that foreign protein on MHC1, right? And if you load it on MHC1, obviously you're going to be able to also degenerate cellular immunity, right? So it's actually very high yield to know for exams that the mRNA vaccines have the ability to develop cellular and humoral immunity. And you will notice there are some subtle things I'll talk about here, but again, they're very high yield to understand. This is especially important for people that are taking step one, right? Because again, these mechanisms, right, are things that people don't understand or kind of give up on, but you really don't need to, right? So the thing is, again, you're getting an adaptive immune response to this. You're getting cellular immunity to this. You're also getting humoral immunity to this, right? I mean, the thing is, if you'll be like, okay, Divine, how does this compare to other vaccines? The thing is, other vaccines have the antigen prepared in the lab and given to you. But essentially, when you're getting an RNA vaccine, you're essentially creating the antigen by yourself, right? It's almost like you're getting like the starter pack, right, to make the antigen yourself. And then because you make that antigen endogenously, because you're making it within your cells, that's why your body is able to generate humoral and cellular immunity, right? And cellular immunity, right? So unlike the lab prepared antigens, right? In this case, you are making the antigen inside your cell, right? You're making the antigen inside your cell. Believe it or not, your cell is actually way more efficient at creating antigen than trying to make it in the lab. Again, this is one of the reasons why the vaccine was very quick to come out, right? Because again, it is way easier, it is way faster making an RNA vaccine than making like an antigen, like a protein-based vaccine, right? Because you have to like design the organisms that are going to get the vaccine, get the genetic material or whatever into you. But now you're just literally giving the genetic material. Although in many cases, you are delivering them with nanoparticles. Obviously, the nanoparticle information is proprietary information to those companies, right? They're like lipid nanoparticles, if I'm not mistaken, right? So, you're going to stimulate cellular immunity, right? Because again, the antigen is produced inside the cell, right? It's not produced outside the cell, right? And the thing is, some of you may wonder, oh, Divine, why did we have to store these vaccines at such ultra cold temperatures? Well, think about it. mRNA is very easily degraded, right? I mean, you've probably learned this from your studies that, for mRNA, many times before we even send it into the cytosol, right? We're going to put the 5' the 5' methyl guanosine cap, right? And then we're going to put the poly A tail, right? Like literally, the poly A tail, we add that with poly A polymerase, right? So we're putting all those things because the cytosol, right, is a rough neighborhood for mRNA, right? So if you already think about that, you can already begin to see why, wow, we need to keep these things at cold temperatures because mRNA is not very stable, right? So it's easily degradable, right? So you have to store it at those cold temperatures, right? So that when you're injecting it into the patient, you can get... have like an effective immune response, right? You can get an effective immune response. Now, the thing is, why is this mRNA vaccine good? The reason mRNA vaccines are good is because think about it again, you don't have to design some organism, right? You are literally only giving genetic material. In fact, you are giving a subset of genetic material, right? You're giving a subset of genetic material, right? So you're not giving an actual organism. So there's actually a lower risk of creating infection, right? To be honest with you, there's a lower risk of creating infection because remember, in many vaccines, you're giving like some, let's say for example, like a live attenuated vaccine because, live attenuated vaccines are actually very good at creating humoral and cellular immunity. But think about it, in a live attenuated vaccine, right? There is a non-zero risk, although it's extremely small, but there's a non-zero risk of that live attenuated virus reverting to a pathogenic state and causing disease in the patient. Right. But the thing is, if you're just giving the genetic material and notice the kind of genetic material that's being given, you're giving mRNA, right? You're giving mRNA. So that thing is not like you're not giving an actual organism, right? So you're essentially almost eliminating the risk of the person getting infection, right? This is one very good advantage over live attenuated vaccines, right? Because again, essentially what I'm trying to teach here is that mRNA vaccines generate humoral and cellular immunity. Live attenuated virus vaccines also generate humoral and cellular immunity, right? But the thing is, live attenuated vaccines, they come at the risk of the live attenuated virus reverting, right? So like the intranasal influenza virus is an example of a live attenuated virus, right? So you have the small risk, right? It's non-zero, it's extremely small, right? That's why these vaccines are still safe. It's extremely small, but there's a non-zero risk of the live attenuated virus reverting, right, to a pathogenic state. And when it reverts to a pathogenic state, you can cause infection, right? You can have like an outbreak in the lab that's also like actually like creating the vaccine or whatever, right? But these mRNA vaccines are good, right? Because again, you're not giving an actual organism, right? So that risk of reverting to a pathogenic state, you're essentially eliminating that risk, right? You're essentially eliminating that risk. In fact, I would not be surprised in the future because many times, when people have HIV, for example, and their CD4 count has plummeted to less than 200, right? Or people are pregnant, right? Or people are less than a year old, right? We don't give these people live attenuated virus vaccines. With the advent of these mRNA vaccines, those restrictions may be lifted because again, you're essentially getting the same benefit from a vaccine, but you're getting that much less risk, right? So mRNA vaccines, I this is maybe me being a little prophetic here, but I strongly suspect that they're going to be the vaccines of the future. All over the world, right? All over the world, all over the world. And some people may say, oh, Divine, are there other benefits of this? Can this mRNA thing go into our genome, right? Because again, that's one common misinformation that is out there. Can this thing, integrate into the genome and cause lots and lots and lots of problems and alter our DNA and stuff. Really, it cannot, right? Because again, first things first, look at what is happening, right? The vaccine that's being given, again, I'm still on the first kind of vaccine, right? The vaccine that's being given, it's an mRNA vaccine. It's an RNA vaccine, right? So because you are giving mRNA, right? Again, notice you're not giving DNA. You're not giving something that can integrate into the genome, right? You're not giving something that can integrate into the genome. And the thing is that mRNA, right after it's translated, right, in the cytosol, remember, mRNA translation, for the most part, does not happen in the nucleus. It happens in the cytosol, right? The moment it's done being translated, it's going to be degraded in the cytosol, right? So again, the risk of that in filtrating into the person's DNA and integrating is really low. But again, I know some people that have very good viral knowledge. They will say, Divine, come on, give me a break. Can't this mRNA encounter, like, you know, can't it maybe somehow by some magic get into the nucleus, encounter reverse transcriptase, be converted to DNA, and then integrate into the genome? Yeah, that's a good thought. But let's think about this. The thing is, mRNA, right? You know, let's say if, again, by some miracle, it makes its way into the nucleus and encounters reverse transcriptase. Yes, reverse transcriptase can convert that mRNA to DNA, and then that DNA can integrate into the genome. But think about this. The mRNA vaccines that are being given, many of them are not given with primers of any sort, right? Because again, you need like almost like viral primer to make all those things happen, right? So the thing is, for reverse transcriptase to work, it almost needs to be activated by primer. So the thing is, even if that mRNA were to get into the person's nucleus, there's literally no primer available for that mRNA to then bind to reverse transcriptase to initiate that reverse transcription process, right? So again, essentially, the risk of this, at least these mRNA vaccines integrating to a person's genome, is almost zero, is essentially zero. But you know, in science, you should probably never say, oh, 100% or 0%, right? But the risk is pretty close to zero, if not essentially zero, right? So the thing is, for the most part, again, it essentially does not integrate into the person's genome, right? So again, these vaccines, they're pretty decent. And again, they are made pretty quickly, right? I mean, like the Pfizer vaccine, the Pfizer BioNTech vaccine, I think it was made in like 22 days. Although, you know, they had to do all this optimization or whatever. The Moderna vaccine, I think, was even made in a shorter period of time, right? So again, very high yield. Again, like if you notice some of these things I'm explaining, right, they're just applications of basic science principles that, you know, most people should know, right? At least people that are studying for step one should know, I would hope, right? So the thing is, so that's the first class of vaccines, right? So again, these mRNA vaccines, there's two of them, right? I said there are 12 vaccines total, right? Now, there are four vaccines that actually like inactivated or killed virus vaccines, right? These are inactivated or killed virus vaccines. And remember, if a person is taking an inactivated or killed virus vaccine, these vaccines should technically only generate humoral immunity. They should not generate cellular immunity. In fact, I'm going to take a small sidebar here and maybe kind of make this point very, very clear and obvious, right? It's a concept that I don't know, for whatever bizarre reason, people just get the fact in many of these resources that exist out there that, oh, you know, a live attenuated vaccine will generate lifelong immunity. It'll generate cellular and humoral immunity. But, oh, a killed virus vaccine only generates humoral immunity. It almost never generates cellular immunity. Or if it does it in very small measure, right? So many times people just accept this fact. But the thing is, it actually makes sense if you really think about it. So what's the pathophysiology here, right? Think about it. When you give a person a live attenuated vaccine, you're giving vaccine that is an organism that is not dead, right? You've attenuated the ability of the organism to cause disease, but you've not attenuated the ability of the organism to infect a cell, right? I'll say that again. When you give a person a live attenuated vaccine, you've attenuated the ability of the organism to cause disease, but you have not attenuated the ability of the organism to infect a cell, right? Because remember, there are two kinds of antigens. And again, maybe I'll probably do like an immunology review so that I can really buttress these points. There are two kinds of antigens. There are exogenous antigens and there are endogenous antigens. Exogenous antigens are antigens that are outside of a cell, right? So you can bring them in by phagocytosis, and you know, you can present them on MHC2. Endogenous antigens are antigens that you make within your cells, right? Those antigens, right, they go through a different pathway, so they can be presented on MHC class 1, right? And when something is presented on MHC class 1, then you have the ability to generate cell-mediated immunity, right? So again, the long and short of this is that a live attenuated vaccine, it still has the ability to infect cells, right? So it can become an endogenous antigen. It can be presented on MHC class 1, and it can generate T-cell immunity. That's what we usually call cell-mediated immunity, right? But on the other hand, a killed vaccine, right? So say, for example, like the Salk polio vaccine. Remember the Salk, the K at the end of Salk can help you remember it's a killed vaccine, right? These killed vaccines, they lack the ability to infect cells, right? So the thing is, because they lack the ability to infect cells, these antigens remain exogenous, right? They remain exogenous, right? The thing is, exogenous antigen can only be presented by antigen-presenting cells on MHC class 2, right? And in that MHC class 2, you know, we'll bind to these CD4 positive helper T cells, right? And then, you know, those CD4 helper T cells, they will produce cytokines and stuff for class switching, right? So this is why killed vaccines only generate humoral immunity. Again, it's a mute point, but this point is floridly high yield to know, right? I can imagine some people listening to this podcast now are like, wow, I've never really understood this stuff before, right? Again, the first time I learned this information a couple years ago, I was like, wow, why does this thing just not show up in any resource, right? So again, this is something that you actually need to understand, right? So believe it or not, there are killed virus vaccines. I almost feel like I'm doing an immunology review right now. But again, you know, I'm going to title this the COVID-19 podcast, right? So there are like 4 inactivated or killed virus vaccines that are currently available actually for COVID-19, right? So again, I said that the mRNA vaccines, there's 2 of them, right? Those generate cellular and humoral immunity. Right? These inactivated or killed virus vaccines, right? They only generate humoral immunity, right? They should not induce cellular immunity. Again, if we're just going with the science here, right? And then there's also 4 vaccines that are viral vector vaccines, right? Essentially, you're essentially using like a modified virus, right? So it may not even be a coronavirus, maybe like a different kind of virus, right? And you're essentially delivering the genetic material of the coronavirus, right? Like basically you're delivering material from, I won't necessarily say genetic material, but you're delivering material from the coronavirus using a modified virus, right, to human cells, right? So that the immune system can respond, right? There's, again, about 4 vaccines that kind of fall under this category. In fact, the AstraZeneca, the Oxford vaccine, is a viral vector vaccine. The Johnson & Johnson vaccine is also a viral vector vaccine, right? And actually, one thing that may help here is to actually remember that the Ebola, because there is actually a vaccine against Ebola, the Ebola vaccine is actually a modified virus vector vaccine, right? So in general, again, these things, you don't have any integration into your own DNA, right? You don't have any integration into your own DNA with these vaccines. And then there are also protein subunit vaccines. There's about 2 of those, right? So 2 of total, right? So the 4 classes of vaccines, there's for coronavirus, there's the mRNA vaccine, right? There's 2 of those. And then there's the killed virus vaccines. There's 4 of those. There is the viral vector vaccines. There's 4 of those, right? So that's 10 total. And then there's the protein subunit vaccine, right? There's 2 of those. That's 12, right? That's 12 vaccines total, right? So how do we manage people that have COVID-19? Well, for the most part, we manage these people with supportive care, right? We manage these people with supportive care. We give them NSAIDs, right, to help with their fevers and some of the inflammatory symptoms, right? Now, the thing is, if you see any evidence of hypoxia, right, the presence of O2 sats are low, the big thing you want to remember for MBM exams is to give these people steroids. Give them dexamethasone. Dexamethasone is actually one of those things that has been shown to improve survival in people that have COVID-19, right? It actually has a mortality benefit. I think there were some studies that were done, I think, in the UK that showed like a 30% reduction in mortality, right, in people that got dexamethasone, right, in the setting of a severe COVID-19, right? Now, obviously, these people are hypoxic, right? You're also going to give them other stuff, like you can give them like 100% oxygen, right? Usually, there's like an oxygen chain that is followed in managing these patients, right? You know, if they're hypoxic, you're going to start off by giving them 100% oxygen, right? By nasal cannula. But then if that doesn't work, you then have to switch to one of two options, right? You can either do like high flow nasal cannula, right? Again, maybe in the future, you know, God willing, I'll make podcasts on like oxygen delivery and how like different methods for delivering oxygen or like ICU machines and all that stuff. Maybe I should even do an ICU series, but again, that's in the future, right? So you can do like high flow nasal cannula. But another thing you can also do instead of high flow nasal cannula is non-invasive positive pressure ventilation, right? So like BiPAP essentially. Although in general, high-flow nasal cannula is preferred over BiPAP, right? High-flow nasal cannula is preferred over BiPAP. I mean, there's actually been studies. I think some of these studies were actually done pretty early when COVID-19 was a thing that showed that high-flow nasal cannula in general was, I believe it reduced the need for intubation compared to having BiPAP, right? And again, another thing you kind of need to remember about BiPAP is that it's an aerosol-generating procedure, right? So it's kind of a high-risk procedure for healthcare workers, right? And then obviously, if this non-invasive positive pressure ventilation or high-flow nasal cannula doesn't work, right, you're going to go ahead and proceed to intubation, right? You're going to proceed to intubation. And if intubation is not really helping a person, right, and they have like profound hemodynamic compromise, then sadly you have to proceed to ECMO, right? Extracorporeal membrane oxygenation. Again, I'm really, really hoping that I can have an ICU series in the future where I talk about some of these machines that we use in the ICU. It's actually a lot of fun, right? Like ventilators, ECMO machines, high-flow nasal cannulas, Swan-Ganz catheters, right? Not just telling you, oh, this is what the machine does. Obviously, that'd be a waste of your time. You can look that up on your own. But kind of going into detail of like the pathophysiology, the physiology behind these machines, right? And what they record, right? And how they help. Like, I mean, ECMOs are very fascinating, right? There's like a ton of stuff with ECMOs, like how they oxygenate, how they take over your heart and your lung function and all that fun stuff. But you know, that's a future podcast. That'll be too much for this, right? I mean, this is almost an hour already, right? Now, another thing you also want to think of, that you also want to think about that you hear is the drug remdesivir, right? Remdesivir. For the most part, remdesivir is used in people that, you know, are not going to require intubation, right? For the most part, yes, it's approved in certain countries, but in general, it's not super recommended, right? Because the thing is, pretty much all it does is it kind of shortens your time to recovery, right? But for the most part, it doesn't really, at least as far as I know from my research, it doesn't seem to have much of any mortality benefit, right? It doesn't seem to have much of any mortality benefit, right? So it shortens the time to recovery, right? So it's kind of like the way when a person has the flu, if within 72 hours of the onset of symptoms, you give them like, You give them a Tamiflu. What's the name of this thing? Yeah, oseltamivir, right? Oseltamivir, zanamivir, right? Those things, they don't necessarily cure the infection, but they reduce your number of symptomatic days. That's essentially what, basically, like, think of remdesivir, like, in exam terms, in USMLE terms, as almost like the oseltamivir or zanamivir of COVID-19, right? It shortens your time to recovery, but for the most part, as far as I know, at least, again, from the research I've done, it's not really recommended. In fact, there are certain organizations that do not recommend remdesivir, right? Now, the thing is, again, these people, when you're giving them oxygen therapy, again, you want to give them oxygen therapy and go no more than 96%, right? Because again, many people don't realize this. Oxygen is a metabolic toxin, right? Oxygen is a metabolic toxin, right? So just like hypoxia is bad, hyperoxia is also a problem, right? Because again, remember, when you have tons of oxygen around, it can cause a lot of free radical damage, right? I mean, this is one of the reasons why bleomycin is such a toxic drug to the lungs, right? Bleomycin literally sensitizes the lung to oxygen-mediated free radical damage, right? That's literally the primary mechanism behind bleomycin causing pulmonary fibrosis. Right. So hyperoxia, I mean, like, again, if you even think about kids that have neonatal respiratory distress syndrome, right, and you see them developing like retinopathy of prematurity, interventricular hemorrhage, bronchopulmonary dysplasia, again, many of those things are free radical mediated issues. Right. So hyperoxia is a problem. In fact, you would see that in certain circumstances, giving oxygen is not the fix for someone's hypoxia. Again, this is something I'll probably go ahead and talk about in my, you know, I think I'm pretty resolute on maybe going ahead and doing some kind of ICU series. But again, I think I want to establish this fact. That's why, again, it's really sad that many people are going into, again, is one of these sad things that happens with this memorization heavy generation we currently live in. You see many people, many healthcare practitioners, or, you know, some people that are, you know, practicing healthcare that are not physicians, right? They just know certain, you know certain things, but you don't necessarily understand, right? So that's where you need to be careful. I'm not saying that, you know, oh, we should disenfranchise some part of healthcare. No. What I'm saying is, as you're learning, put mechanisms in place to actually make sure people are actually understanding what's going on. Again, oxygen is not always the fix for hypoxia. Again, I know some of you may be like, no, define, this doesn't make any sense. If a person has low oxygen, give oxygen, right? But that's algorithm-based thinking. Algorithm-based thinking is not always smart, right? That's why usually some of the best ICU physicians are people that have actually spent time, and you see that they actually think about the patient. They think about the science. They think about the pathophysiology, right? So those people are usually a lot more targeted in their approach to care. They're usually a lot more structured, a lot more prudent in their approach to care, because they just have the salient understanding, right? They have that salient understanding. So I think it's kind of an important thing to actually keep at the back of your mind as a physician, right? Or as, again, a healthcare practitioner, right? Even if your school that you're going to as a healthcare practitioner is not teaching you pathophysiology, take it as your own responsibility that, you know what, I want to take good care of my patients, right? So let me actually understand pathophysiology so I don't kill patients for any reason, right? Again, I'll say this, but again, I think I'll examine this thought more when we go into the ICU series. But in general, there are certain situations, right? There are certain situations where oxygen is not the best immediate treatment for a patient's hypoxia, right? Oxygen is not always the solution to hypoxia. Again, the meat is in the pathophysiology, right? But again, that's a conversation for a different day, right? And then obviously these people go into shock, right? So again, sorry I went off on that rant, but I think it's kind of a message that needs to be heard, right? But again, I think I also need to be prudent in the way I express some of these messages, right? Again, because again, we live in an atmosphere where everything is offensive, right? So, you know, kind of have to be careful with your speech in this day and age, right? So if these people go into shock, right? Again, obviously they will likely have some kind of septic shock. Remember, when a person has septic shock, right? So, you know, it's a distributive shock, right? So these people, they have a decrease in systemic vascular resistance, right? So because the systemic vascular resistance goes down, right? So the cardiac output is going to go up, right? The cardiac output is going to go up because it's just easier for the left ventricle to eject with blood. That's one factoid, right? And then remember that in people that have septic shock, right? They are PCWP, so their pulmonary capillary wedge pressures, which is a surrogate for left atrial pressure, and your central venous pressure, which is a surrogate for right atrial pressure. Remember, all the veins drain into the right atrium, right? So it makes sense that the central venous pressure, the central hub for all your veins pressure, right, should be a good surrogate for right atrial pressure, right? And then it's also helpful to understand, right, that when people have septic shock, right, their MVO2 is actually high, right? Their MVO2 is actually high. Again, I don't want this podcast to get unwieldy here, but remember, people that have septic shock, because they have that decrease in systemic vascular resistance, blood flows very quickly, right? Flows very, very, very quickly through their tissues, right? And again, as the blood flows very quickly through, you know, zips through their tissues, there is inadequate oxygen extraction, right? Happening, right? So because there is inadequate extraction of oxygen, the oxygen tension of the blood that gets to the right atrium actually ends up being higher than you would imagine, right? So MVO2 is usually high especially in early septic shock. And by the way, for those of you that are taking NBM exams, the numbers they always request, because I know some Q banks get a little excessive here and they talk about early septic shock and late septic shock. On NBM exams, if you get a septic shock question, assume that they are testing the values in early septic shock. So the cardiac output is up, the systemic vascular resistance is down, the pulmonary capillary wedge pressure, which is the left atrial pressure, is down, the CVP, the central venous pressure, which is the right atrial pressure, is down, and the MVO2, which is the mixed venous O2 saturation, is up. Those are the numbers, and again, I've kind of explained the pathophase there. Those are the numbers that go along with with septic shock, right? So when people have septic shock, obviously you're going to give them antibiotic therapy if you can find the infection. Although remember, for coronavirus, there's no real antibiotic that can really help you here, right? So we're going to be going more into pressors, right? So usually you want to use norepinephrine. Remember, norepinephrine is the first line pressor in the treatment of septic shock, right? That's what's called levofed in hospitals. It's the first line pressor in septic shock. But let's say for some reason norepinephrine is not doing diddly squat for your patient. What can you do? Well, your second line pressor in the management of septic shock, and this is actually very high yield to know for in-beam exams, is vasopressin, right? Vasopressin is the second line pressor that's used in the management of septic shock, right? And then your third line pressor is epinephrine, right? So remember NVE. You start with norepinephrine. If that doesn't work, proceed to vasopressin. If that doesn't work, proceed to epinephrine, right? So the thing is, back in the day, there were guidelines that said to use dopamine, but don't use dopamine. Again, you may see some old NBME questions where, oh, giving dopamine in the setting of septic shock is the right thing to do, but not these days, right? Dopamine is no longer indicated, right? I mean, this has been for years. Dopamine is no longer indicated for the management. Basically, don't use it as a pressor in septic shock, right? And when people have septic shock, go ahead and give them fluids, right? So if you're giving them fluids, don't try to use colloid solutions. Don't try to use albumin. No, don't do any of that stuff. If a person has septic shock, you can use either normal saline or you can use lactated Ringer solution. Although one problem with normal saline is that it can potentially cause like a hyperchloremic metabolic acidosis. Again, the mechanisms behind these things, that's for the ICU series, right? Again, hopefully, you know, God makes it possible for me to make those podcasts, right? But so if a person is developing like a hyperchloremic metabolic acidosis, you may want to go ahead and use lactated Ringers. But for the most part, if a person is going through septic shock, normal saline, usually on NBM exams, is the right thing to do, right? But lactated Ringers, if you don't see normal saline as an answer, if they tell you that, oh, the patient has a hyperchloremic metabolic acidosis, then you can go ahead in those patients and use lactated Ringers, right? If a person has hyperchloremic metabolic acidosis, lactated Ringers is great in these people, right? And again, remember, when a person has septic shock, usually your goal for the mean arterial pressure is between somewhere between 60 and 65, right? The mean arterial pressure, you want to keep it somewhere between 60 and 65. Remember, 60 and 65 for your mean arterial pressures, right? And again, obviously, these people, if they are having like very severe respiratory failure, you need to put them on a ventilator, right? So on a ventilator, again, since these people for the most part have ARDS, for the most part, you're going to put them on low tidal volumes, right? Because again, you don't want them to suffer barotrauma, right? You want to cut down on this thing called ventilator-induced lung injury, right? So you put them on low tidal volumes, right? Usually you do like a tidal volume of like 6 milliliters per kilogram of predicted body weight, right? So if, for example, a person's predicted body weight is 70 kilograms, right? They should be on roughly a tidal volume of about 420 milliliters, right? 70 times 6, right? And you also want to put these people on high PEEP, right? If you put them on high PEEP, again, you're essentially going to be recruiting more alveoli to participate in gas exchange, right? And usually also these people that have like really bad respiratory failure, one thing you can also do for them, it's actually been shown, I believe, to improve survival, is to put them in a prone position, right? So basically lie these people on their chest and on their bellies, right? The thing is, it essentially reduces the shunt fraction in the lungs. Again, these terms you're hearing me spit out, right? I'm going to talk about them in the context of like the ICU series, right? Because again, if you remember, a shunt is where you have regions of lung that are ventilated, but they are not being perfused, right? In general, when you put the person in a prone position, again, usually you want to do it for about 12 to 16 hours. When you put a person in a prone position, that's actually going to increase perfusion. I don't know, but like maybe to give some people like a hint of why this is important. Some of you may potentially remember that, there's like zone 1, zone 2, zone 3 of the lung, and those differences in pressures of the pulmonary capillaries versus the alveoli and stuff. Basically, when the person gets in a prone position, you're optimizing those pressures to increase perfusion of many parts of the lung. So you're kind of cutting down on that shunt fraction. But again, we will say some more things about that. Again, remember, shunt is... you're being perfused, but you essentially have regions of lung that are being oxygenated, but they are not being perfused. Sorry if I mixed that up there. So let me say that again. Shunt is when you have regions of lung that are being oxygenated, but they are not being perfused, right? They're being oxygenated, but they are not being perfused. They're being oxygenated, they are not being perfused, right? I don't know, I feel like I'm saying the wrong thing for shunt. I hope I'm not mixing this up. Yeah, because, okay, let me try to reason this out, right? So right to left shunt, right? So the blood is basically skipping the lungs. It's not getting oxygenation. Oh, okay. My apologies there. So actually a shunt is when you have the lungs, they are being perfused, but they are not being oxygenated, right? They are being perfused, but they are not being oxygenated. Sorry about that. My apologies there, right? So those regions of lung, again, they are being perfused, but they are not being oxygenated, right? So basically, by being in a prone position, you reduce that shunt fraction, right? You basically take away that shunt physiology. So that's part of the reason it improves survival, right? And then, so again, low tidal volumes, high PEEP, prone positioning, low plateau pressures, right? So plateau pressures are basically pressures you get where if a person takes a full inspiration, like literally at the end of inspiration, you pause and then you take the pressures in the airway, right? That's essentially what the plateau pressures are. You want to keep those plateau pressures low again so that you can reduce the risk of barotrauma, right? So it's going to be less than 30. You want to keep that below 30, right? Because believe it or not, for some bizarre reason on step one, they do actually ask about plateau pressures every now and then. And then just two quick tidbits of information I want to say here. In kids, sometimes they can have this thing that's is related to COVID-19, but it's called pediatric multi-system inflammatory syndrome. It's kind of similar to Kawasaki's disease, actually, right? And it can actually cause death in COVID-19, although in general, kids that get COVID-19, their mortality rate is way lower. And then the final thing I will say is that the case fatality rate for COVID-19 globally is roughly 2.2%, right? So for every 100 people that get COVID-19, about 2.2 of them are going to die, right? Which is really sad, right? So hopefully with the initiation of the vaccine, that can cut down on some of this mortality. So as I do at the end of every, I think I'm going to go ahead and stop here. I mean, this is more than an hour already, so this is not unwieldy. As I do at the end of every podcast, please subscribe to the podcast website, divineinterventionpodcast.com. And I also have, basically, if I make a new podcast, you'll get an email notification. And all the podcasts from episode 1 all the way to, I guess, 300 now, they're always going to be on the website. Because, you know, I also have these podcasts on Apple Podcasts, on Google Podcasts, on Spotify. The only problem with those is it's like a WordPress rule. You can basically only see the first one, the most recent 150, right? So if you want all the podcasts, you have to go to the website and actually like download it there or listen to it from there. And then I have a YouTube channel, Divine Intervention USMLE Podcasts and Videos. That's where I post the videos that I make. So subscribe. And if I make any videos, which I do, you'll be able to view them there. And then if you need tutoring, I offer one-on-one tutoring for the USMLE exams. So step 1, step 2 CK, step 3, preclinical med school exams, third year clerkship shelf exams. And if you're a medicine resident and you need tutoring for the medicine in training exam or the medicine boards, I do also offer one-on-one tutoring for those. And then for those of you that are taking step 2 CK, step 3 anytime soon, I do offer a comprehensive course. I have an MBME test taking strategies course that's 2.5 hours. It's on the 27th of April of this month. And then if we go to the very end of the month, from the 28th of April to the 1st of May, I have a 20-hour, right? So it's 5 hours for 4 days. Super comprehensive step 2 CK, step 3 course. Covers, again, peds, psych, neuro, IM, surgery, OB-GYN, and even the new changes that have shown forth on the exam. Biostats ethics, I cover all those things. Healthcare systems, all those things are amply covered in the course. So if that's something you're interested in, just shoot me an email through the website and I'll give you more information on the cost and things of that nature. So thank you for listening to this podcast. I will see you next time. God bless you and have a wonderful day. And stay safe and practice social distancing. Thank you.